You know, you see all those other people getting their medals, watching TV, you know. Everybody's getting medals every day, and you just want one for yourself. So hopefully we can bring home that gold medal.
The pool sound system played American Woman to honor the Americans as they celebrated with hugs and high fives. The team has been one of the best in the world since water polo arrived at the Olympics 8 years ago, but they have yet to win a gold medal. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Beijing.
And in wrestling, American Henry Cejudo defeated Japan's Tomohiro Matsunaga in the men's freestyle 55-kilogram wrestling event at the Olympics today. On Wall Street, the Dow is down nearly 160 points at 11,320. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera. Sinfonia, under the musical direction of Ian Hobson, wishes to thank their patrons for 25 wonderful years and invites everyone to a season of beloved classics, rare works, and exciting new pieces. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the history of the Cold War and look back to what many people would argue would be the defining moment of the Cold War. This was a span of 13 days when the world had its closest ever brush with nuclear destruction. What we're talking about here is the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, there are some people who would argue that the fact that the United States and the Soviet Union did not engage in nuclear war was just a matter of luck. However, our guest for this morning, journalist Michael Dobbs, takes a very different view. We'll be talking about his newly published book, 1 Minute to Midnight, the subtitle Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. It's published by Knopf. In the book, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about recent Russian history and specifically about the life of one individual. Now, although it was Mikhail Gorbachev who was responsible for the decline of the Communist Party, it was Boris Yeltsin who was the first elected leader in the long history of Russia. It was Yeltsin who buried the Soviet Union itself. Even after his death in 2007, he remains the most controversial figure in recent Russian history. This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll explore why and how Yeltsin broke with single-party rule and launched his drive to replace it with democracy. And our guest for the program is Timothy Colton. He's professor of government and Russian studies and also director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. He is the author of many books and articles on Soviet and Russian history and politics, and is the author of a recently published biography of Boris Yeltsin. The title is Yeltsin, A Life. It is published by Basic Books. It is out now in the bookstores if you'd like to read it. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people when they call in to join in the conversation is to keep their comments as brief as possible, just so we can keep things moving along, get in as many callers as we can. But certainly, questions are welcome. If you would like to join the conversation, the number for folks who are in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one would be good if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the Internet. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Professor Colton, hello.
Morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
It certainly seems to me that one might be hard-pressed to find a character as complex and with as many contradictions as this man that we'll be talking about, Boris Yeltsin.
I certainly agree with that, and it's a key theme in the book. It made him a fascinating subject to study, but it also made it very hard to draw conclusions about him.
Yeah. It also seems that one thing that's very striking about this man is that it seems that there were many points in his career where people said, well, he's finished. He's down. He's down for the count. There's no way that he's coming back. And yet he kept coming back, at least until the very end, where he surprised a lot of people at the end of 1999 and resigned. It does seem to be that he was someone who had, for a long time, had remarkable resilience.
Oh, to say the least. In fact, I would argue that even his retirement on the last day of the 20th century was a surprise in terms of his influence, because it was widely believed that he would just kind of slink away from power. And in fact, he did it on his own timing and selected somebody who was otherwise barely known to the mass of the population. So yes, resilience, physical toughness. It's not that he didn't suffer sometimes from the situations he was in and created for himself, but he was nothing if not tough. And in particular, I think you see this in his period as a national politician, which is from 1985 roughly until the end of the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. One other general thing before we get to specifics, I think that perhaps over time one of the things that was said about him was that there were people who were in the shadows who were the ones who were truly making the decisions, and that somehow that Yeltsin was just the front.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was said quite frequently starting around 1993 or so, and then more loudly at the end of the 1990s. And one of his opponents in the 1993 constitutional crisis, which led to Russian tanks shelling the parliament building and all the rest, said that Russia was really governed by a collective Rasputin, as he said. If most of your readers will recognize that reference, the shadowy monk behind the scenes in the dying days of the Russian Empire. And the charge was restated around 1997-98 to the effect that Russia was now really governed by something called the family, with a capital letter, capital F, capital S in Russian, and that Yeltsin was really just a front man. But I don't believe it in either case. In 1993, he, in fact, quelled his opposition and did so. Of course, he had allies and people who cooperated with him, but it's perfectly clear that he was the person really driving events. In the late 90s, it's a little bit more complicated because his health problems by this time were such that he was rarely in the public eye, and I think a lot of the problem towards the end of the 90s was his invisibility and his obviously poor health. And so people tended to assume, well, if he's not doing things, then somebody else might be. And the particular group that was fingered, the so-called family, was said to consist of his daughter, Tatiana, several government officials associated with her and with Yeltsin, and with a business tycoon named Berezovsky, Boris Berezovsky. I don't think that charge was fully justified either, although it could well be that he kind of got more input from some of these people than was healthy. But the idea that he was under this thumb is I completely reject.
Mm. Our guest this hour is Timothy Colton. He's professor of government and Russian studies at Harvard University. He is the author of a new biography of Boris Yeltsin. It's published by Basic Books. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the big questions is why it was that Boris Yeltsin would take on and ultimately bring down the Communist Party. He was, after all, had been a member of the party for something like 30 years, almost 30 years. And one explanation that you offer, and I think that this is perhaps new based on new information that you'd been able to ferret out, it had to do with the way that the party treated his family. And this was something that goes back, in fact, even before Boris Yeltsin was born.
Yeah, that's right. This is something I stumbled across, not really knowing the story was there at all. And essentially, his grandparents, all four of them, and his two parents really suffered very significantly in the late 20s, early 1930s. Yeltsin was born in 1931, and he was literally conceived in one village and born in another, the reason being that the whole lot of them had been forced out of their home to move to this other village. Eventually, the four grandparents ended up in the kind of penumbra of the gulag. So they were exiled to the north. They weren't under lock and key in a camp, but they were, you know, exiles living very lonely and terrible lives. His father also was arrested in 1934 spent 3 years working in a construction camp, building the canal from Moscow to the Volga. So all of this happened to his family. Now, Gorbachev's family didn't have only happy experiences either. There certainly were arrests in his immediate family. What was different was that, on the whole, the Gorbachevs were from that segment of Russian or Soviet society that welcomed the Russian Revolution and that saw their lives change more or less for the better when the revolution was carried out at the social level, societal level, at the end of the 1920s. So Yeltsin, Gorbachev's grandfather, was the first chairman of the collective farm in their village, whereas the Yeltsin family over there in the Urals, almost in Siberia, were among the victims. Now, of course, it's not a simple thing to trace a causal link between events that occur many decades before and outcomes many decades afterwards. I can only say that I'm convinced now that it's part of the explanation and that there was a certain element of alienation or skepticism on Yeltsin's part. And we have some markers for this. First of all, family members confirmed that this was indeed so. But also, you mentioned joining the party. He joins the party in 1961, and he told me flat out he didn't want to. He did it because he was required to in order to be promoted in his job. Whereas Gorbachev, born in the same year, in the same spring of 1931, actually joined the Communist Party in the early 50s before Stalin's death. And he did it because he fully bought into the ideology and point of view. So I think that's a significant difference. It's not the whole explanation, but it's something quite unexpected that I stumbled across.
Yeah. So what was Boris Yeltsin like as a boy?
Oh, he was a very lively boy. I mean, as a very young child, his dispossessed family took him all over the place in search of refuge. But he grew up in a smallish industrial city called Berezniki on the western inclines of the Ural Mountains. And it was a chemical. It was based on, located on salt deposits. And it was the center of the Soviet chemical industry in the interwar period. So it was a challenging environment for anybody, including a young boy, but I think he made the best of it. I think his family generally was stoic, and they let him fend for himself in the world of little boys and girls. By the time he goes to secondary school, so this would be starting just after the war, the schools in the Soviet Union were segregated by sex. So he went to an all-boys school, which probably accentuated this tendency. But he wrote with great pleasure, in the first volume of his memoirs about all the adventures that happened to him, some of which weren't so much fun. He got the thumb and the index finger of his left hand were blown off by a hand grenade, which he and some of his buddies stole from a warehouse in 1942 or 1943. Now, when I went to Berezniki, I wanted to check if these stories were true, but I was there many, many years after the fact. But I have to say, I found almost no disconfirming evidence that Yeltsin was had a rebellious streak, that he was a handful, that he was very quick and ambitious, but wasn't afraid to disagree and to do things that were kind of cut against the grain. So that's the kind of boyhood he had, and I think he looked back on it with great warmth and fondness. Mm-hmm. And like I say, everything I saw there suggested that, except for some details, of course, which are discussed in Chapter 3, I think it is, of the book, the picture he drew of himself was largely accurate.
He went to university. He studied civil engineering and after graduation worked in things like housing construction and industrial development. And at a rather young age, he got a very significant post. He essentially was the party head in Sverdlovsk, which is an area that is known for concentration of heavy industry. How did he end up with that position?
Yes, in Sverdlovsk, which has now been given its original name, Ekaterinburg, was a center not only for heavy industry like metals and mining, but also defense production. It was the part of Russia with the densest concentration of military armaments factories. He was not particularly young when he got this job. In fact, he was 45 years old, which was about average. He had joined the party late, so it only took him 15 years, from 61 to 76 to rise to the top in his region. I think what was different was that he was extremely vigorous and he was youthful in his ways, even though chronologically he was not that much younger than the typical party boss when they were promoted to the position. Now, what was, and perhaps what you're thinking about this, by the late Brezhnev period, we all remember that period of stagnation, people once appointed in positions like this tended to stay there for year after year or even decade after decade. Mm. That made him younger than the other average incumbent, but not necessarily younger than people when they were first appointed.
So how was it then he came to the attention of Gorbachev and Ligachev and then got called to Moscow?
Well, he was good at what he did, no question. So it was his qualities as a supervisor, as a motivator, as a leader in a work or business setting that brought him to the attention of the party out in the Urals. This eventually leads to his promotion of first secretary there. He had a mentor, a patron who smoothed the way for him. As far as Moscow is concerned, it came in 1985. He had been under exploration for this kind of transfer since the days of Yuri Andropov, if you remember him, who was briefly Soviet leader in the early 1980s. I think what they liked about him were the qualities that essentially made him a successful regional leader. That is, he worked like the Dickens. He had a way of hooking up with people. He had empathy with others. He could motivate individuals to work hard. And he was very success-oriented, a person with a great drive to succeed. And Gorbachev felt that this was these were qualities that he could harness. Now, as I show in the book, though, Gorbachev did have certain doubts about Yeltsin's character and personality, and he was sorely advised by others not to do this. Yeltsin already had a lot of enemies in high places who thought he was too rambunctious, too egotistical, and too hard to cope with, too much to handle. Gorbachev listened to these criticisms and then simply overruled them, and so Yeltsin got the job. He got it in stages, but by the end of 1985, he was the Communist Party boss in the city of Moscow, which is, in American terms, kind of like Washington, New York, and maybe Detroit rolled into one. It was the center of everything.
It seems that when he first got there, at least, he felt, that is, Yeltsin felt that he wasn't being given the kind of position that he felt that he should have?
You know, it seems like a trivial thing. And when I first heard the story, which is in Yeltsin's first memoir volume, I thought he must be kidding. But it turned out that he wasn't. The first job that he was given in Moscow was one that he felt was beneath his dignity. It was a demotion. He had to accept less power and influence, but as a way of getting to Moscow. So he kind of swallowed his pride, but he was very frank with his colleagues that he didn't appreciate this, that he was not eager to go to Moscow just to do anything. And he was already being critical of Gorbachev, which is, again, something new that I came across and is quite counterintuitive. Gorbachev clearly saw good qualities in Yeltsin but had some reservations. It was mutual. I think that Yeltsin very much supported the reform initiatives, but he also, I think, felt that Gorbachev was probably not the best person to carry them out.
Well, so here now at this point, Yeltsin he's come a long way. He's now the leading official in the most important city and a man, no doubt, with a great deal of power and influence.
And a member of the Politburo.
And a member of the Politburo and had the sort of troubled relationship with Mr. Gorbachev. Then there was a serious falling out between Gorbachev and Yeltsin, perhaps in part because Yeltsin felt that reform wasn't moving fast enough. Was there more to it than that? Was this personal?
I think it was personal by this time. On the public record, there's nothing to indicate that there was a personal side to it. But Yeltsin was quite outspoken in public about his insistence that reform, perestroika as they called it, had to move more quickly. However, declassified archival documents that I got access to showed very clearly that at Politburo meetings in behind closed doors, Yeltsin was disagreeing with Gorbachev kind of left and right, and Gorbachev chided him repeatedly for being too caustic in his comments and too impatient. For about a year or so, Yeltsin did what he was expected to do, and he criticized, but that was all he did. But suddenly, in the fall of 1987. he simply got exasperated with the whole situation and decided to resign. That was his initial move, was to send Gorbachev a letter saying, I quit, I can't take this anymore. Absolutely remarkable. And his family told me that they were dumbfounded. What did he think he was doing and what was going to happen to them? But Gorbachev, rather than either accept the resignation or oppose it or reject it, simply ignored it. He told Yeltsin they would meet to talk about it, but maybe a couple of months from now. And this further infuriated Yeltsin. So he went from a letter of resignation and an act of protest to the decision, which was made clearly on the spot at the last moment, to stand up in front of the party central committee, which was the several hundred, you know, movers and shakers in the Soviet Union, and to criticize Gorbachev personally. And here you did see the personal element as well as the policy one. Hmm. And this was a cataclysmic event because it hadn't happened essentially since the 1920s. And here was a member of the leadership saying that the general secretary wasn't doing his job. Gorbachev faced a choice. He could have had Yeltsin completely crushed and removed from the capital completely, or he could have, on the other side, he could have said, well, maybe you have a point there. Maybe we should be trying harder and moving more quickly. What he decided to do was kind of a halfway solution. He had Yeltsin denounced and removed from his position, but he didn't go further. So he didn't, of course, there was no question of executing him or anything like that by the 1980s, but he could easily have removed Yeltsin from the scene by making him ambassador to some foreign country or something along those lines. He didn't do so because I think he felt that Yeltsin was finished. There was no reason to go further because it was game over as far as Yeltsin was concerned. And I must tell you that I wrote my first very modest article about Yeltsin in the spring of 1988, 6 months after all this happened, and I agreed with Gorbachev, and it just shows how, you know, we got a lot of things wrong as well. I said, sure, obviously, the man is finished. Nobody comes back. But he did come back, and so that Gorbachev's disrespect of him at that particular moment when the system was starting to open up turned out to give Yeltsin a golden opportunity to develop an independent political reputation, beginning with impatience with reform, which is kind of what he'd been before, but moving eventually within a couple of years to essentially to rejection of the whole system. Mm.
This was one of those points we were talking a little earlier about. One of the things that seems to mark this man is his ability to come back from adversity, and those points where people said, well, this guy's done. He's over.
Right.
There's no way he's coming back. And this period, winter of 1988, was one of those times. But remarkably enough, by about a year later, he was elected to the Congress of People's Deputies, and about, I think, 2 years after that, he was elected President of the Russian Republic, and
that's right.
That's, you know, to see where he was, where he went between from the winter of 1988 to June of 1991. That seems just almost unimaginable, or I'm sure it would have been for a lot of people in 1988. It would have been unimaginable.
Sure, absolutely. Now you have to realize, of course, that many other people, including a lot of ordinary folks, were also moving towards a more critical position. But what distinguished Yeltsin, I think, was his instinctive feel for the moment. And here I think some opportunism was involved. It's not that his motives were entirely noble. But I think he came to realize that he now had a chance to kind of latch on to this popular mood, help radicalize it, and essentially attack Gorbachev from outside the party. And this took him, like you said, really only 2 years. In fact, he's elected to the Soviet Parliament, the last Soviet Parliament, in March 1989, early July 1990, less than 18 months later, he has resigned from the Communist Party. And at that point, he is an opposition figure who's free to operate on the outside. But realize the huge advantage he turned out to have, because he was a radical critic who promised to transform society, who promised the Russians, of all the Soviet peoples, a bright future. But what was different about him is he wasn't a garden variety dissident. He wasn't an academic or an artist or somebody who had suffered terribly in the Soviet period. He was, the dragon slayer who came out of the belly of the dragon. And that reassured a lot of people. Here was somebody who was saying the right things about change, about hope, and the like, but who seemed to know how things actually worked. And he had, you know, street smarts about him. He knew how to get things done. And so I think that was also crucial in his ascent.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Timothy Colton. He is the Morris and Anna Feldberg Professor of Government and Russian Studies and Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. He's the author of a number of books and articles on Soviet and Russian history and politics, including a newly published book, Yeltsin, A Life. It's a biography of Boris Yeltsin, published by Basic Books. It's out now in the bookstores if you'd like to read it. And questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The event that no doubt still has a place in the minds and the imaginations of a lot of people was the attempted coup and this now famous, maybe iconic photograph of Yeltsin standing on top of the tank. This was in August of 1991.
Yeah, that's a remarkable photograph, of course. It was taken by a Russian photographer whose identity is not known. It won prizes, and it's readily available in several forms, but we don't know exactly who took it. That's right. That occurred on August 19th, 1991. So that's really the second extraordinary, I think, kind of box-busting act of his. The first one was the revolt against Gorbachev, and this was his revolt against the people who were trying to unseat Gorbachev from a more conservative position. And that was a traumatic day for him, as for everybody in the Soviet Union, when tanks rolled into the center of Moscow and it looked for a while as if everything was lost. The hardliners were going to triumph. They were going to squelch reform and put an end to all talk of democracy. The individuals who mounted this coup made the terrible mistake, as Gorbachev had before, of underestimating Boris Yeltsin. So they had discussed various plans for arresting him, which would have been not so easy to do because he had a well-armed bodyguard, but they talked about this, but never quite pulled the trigger, so to say. And so, amazingly, they left him free the morning of August 19th as Moscow was flooded with armor to take his car and driver down to his office in the so-called Russian White House or parliamentary headquarters on the Moscow River. And from there, Yeltsin tried to coordinate resistance to the coup. The scene on the tank takes place in the noon hour that morning. It was absolutely unrehearsed. Tanks were approaching the Russian Parliament building, powered, of course, by Soviet troops, who were to encircle it, and eventually the idea was to take it by force if need be. Yeltsin saw the tanks coming and didn't apparently react immediately, but then he saw that one of the drivers of a tank was saying something to people who had started to gather. And so he was impelled by curiosity, as much as anything else, to take the elevator downstairs and see what was going on. He took with him an appeal to the citizens of Russia that he and his allies had composed that morning. And he walked down, marched down the steps, saw the tanks were still moving slowly, and he simply stood in front of one of them. Not because, he told me, and we discussed this at some length, not because he had any intention of getting on top of it. He just wanted to stop it. And he might have seen pictures of perhaps the man who tried to stop the tank in Beijing in 1989 or analogous events. Anyway, he stood in front of this enormous machine, and it stopped. And he then said to me, I realized I knew perfectly well how to get on top of this tank because these particular tanks were built, manufactured, in the very region that he had governed for 15 years, Sverdlovsk. So he knew this machine intimately, and he clambered up on top of it. The gunner reached out to shake his hand, and Yeltsin was there. He was standing in the drizzle. It was drizzling lightly. And then he said, at that point, I thought, well, gee, I have this this petition in my hand. Why don't I read a few words of it? And that's what led to the famous reading of the speech from on top of the tank. It was a brilliantly executed shot. No one could have improved on it. But it's interesting, the photograph, the iconic image, as you rightly put it, that has come down to us, just shows him on this tank with the parliament in the background and with various others having climbed on top of the tank with him. What it doesn't show is that the total crowd in the square in front of the parliament at that point was as small as 150 people. That is, this really was a television moment. Apparently, there were only about 50 brave souls on the square when he first came out. And then when things started to happen, other citizens who'd been in the vicinity walked over to see what was happening. And so the event was only witnessed directly by fewer than 200 people, if you can imagine. But, of course, the photograph was widely circulated. It was shown ever so briefly on Soviet television, which was a terrible mistake that evening. But CNN circulated it immediately. It was on American television. And in Moscow, the capital city, many ordinary people could receive CNN just by hooking up a small antenna to their TV set. So there were huge consequences from that quite remarkable act.
Mm. And this was something that from which it seemed that Gorbachev never really recovered. It damaged him so much that it was simply not possible for him to come back from this.
You know, I don't think that the speech from the tank was, a particular factor in degrading Gorbachev's image, but it formed a great contrast with Gorbachev's inaction, because he was under house arrest. And worse than that, the coup had been carried out by Gorbachev's people. So even though Gorbachev in his own way was a Democrat, by this point he'd become nervous that things were developing too quickly, that somehow they were losing control. And so the hardliners who put him under house arrest and occupied Moscow militarily were all Gorbachev's candidates for these positions. So I think the contrast was very important. But later in the week, as I describe, it was even a bit painful to recount this scene. I think on the Friday of that week, Gorbachev is back in Moscow. The coup has collapsed. The ringleaders are behind bars and so forth. And Gorbachev is invited to come to the Russian parliament, not the Soviet parliament, but the Russian parliament, on Friday the 23rd. And he does, and he's there to answer questions. And so he struggles with, he's in an impossible position. And Yeltsin decides to use this symbolic location, and this was televised live to the entire Soviet population, to really this time really humiliate Gorbachev. And it's a painful scene to watch today. It really is. Because Gorbachev, surely most of us would consider a decent person, but in any case, he was on the wrong side of history here, and Yeltsin just wouldn't let him forget it. And he forced Gorbachev to do two things. First of all, to read out loud from a transcript which showed that most members of Gorbachev's own government had betrayed him that week. And secondly, to sit there idly while Yeltsin signed a decree dissolving the Communist Party on Russian soil. I mean, both of these things broke Gorbachev's heart, and the combination of them was simply more than his reputation could stand. We know that from Brent Scowcroft, President Bush's national security advisor, that George H.W. Bush was watching this scene live on CNN and simply said to his aides, Gorbachev is finished, isn't he? And they just said, you're right. You're going to have to find somebody else to negotiate it with. Hmm. To negotiate with.
And that left Yeltsin being the guy on the top?
It did, but it was messy because, first of all, he decided he was very prone to periods of relaxation and unwinding after moments of crisis. And so he did what he'd done many times before. He disappeared. He went to the beach to get a suntan, literally. He really vacated Moscow and left Gorbachev to fend for himself, partly perhaps calculating that Gorbachev would come to him on bended knee proposing cooperation, which never quite happened. And there was great confusion. I think this was a very dangerous moment, and that probably Yeltsin shouldn't have left Moscow as he did. He's only back in his office, back doing things the first week of October, which is hard to believe, right? The coup is defeated on August 23rd, and Yeltsin is really not on the scene working until the first week of October. But at that point, he pulls himself together and announces that whether or not the Soviet Union is still around, Russia is going to embark on radical economic reform on January 2nd in the new year. Negotiations over the possible prolongation of the Soviet Union as a very loose kind of confederative grouping of states continue until November 25th, but they really fail, partly because Yeltsin is not very cooperative, partly because the Ukrainians, the second largest national group in the Soviet Union, had by this time decided on independence. And so these things lead Yeltsin to take a very hard line in the negotiations. They collapse, and on December 25th, the Soviet flag goes down over the Kremlin, and the Russian flag goes up.
Hmm. I wanted to have you talk about economic reform. This is something certainly mm-hmm. that one could spend a lot of time talking about. But certainly when people think about Yeltsin and what happened during the time that he was leading the government, that's one of the things they're going to think about, and the practical effects of reform, which were, among other things, of a handful of people became extremely wealthy, incredibly wealthy, and a lot of people lost everything. And that I think that a lot of people would argue that that it was, generally speaking, it was a disaster for the country. To what extent is he responsible for that?
Well, I think he's responsible to a very large extent. He, of course, not having any training in economics as we know it on this side of the ocean, had no idea what exactly to do. He had to seek advice, find young reformers, and delegate responsibility to them. What he gave them was time to work, this out, and political cover. So it was generally believed that he would pay the political price if things didn't work, as indeed he did. So yes, in the short term, it was catastrophic, and I think it would have been under almost any leader, because what he was proposing was to go to the move from planning to the market, from state property to private property, and this is truly a revolutionary objective, and it was going to be messy no matter what. But it was probably made more messy by their naivete about how long it was going to take, about how difficult it was going to be. He promised results within a year, and he lived to rue this statement, because it really took more like 7 or 8 years before things started to get better. On the other side, though, one has to say, I mean, Russia today, almost 2 decades after Yeltsin made that decision, has a thriving economy. And it has, on the whole, a market economy. It's not a perfect market economy, but private business essentially dominates the Russian economy, as it does most countries. And I think Yeltsin deserves credit for that. He should have probably done a better and especially a quicker job of dealing with the problem in the 90s. But eventually, results did start to flow. And, you know, his critics, on the whole, tend to fault him for excessive radicalism, but I actually am inclined to think, as far as the economy was concerned, is that it wasn't radical enough. That is, rather than put people through a terrible, shocking moment of disruption, which might have lasted probably 2 or 3 years at a minimum, which is what happened in East Central Europe, for example, rather than do that, he got scared off of his initial objectives and decided to prolong the process, and so it turned out to be a very extended period of economic decline. Year after year, output dropped, and a lot of ordinary people, of course, suffered mightily. No question about that.
Well, how did he feel about that, you know, the fact that indeed a relatively small number of people, and admittedly these were people who were his supporters, became just staggeringly wealthy, and then a lot of people, particularly older folks who were pensioners and essentially were dependent on the state for a lot of things, essentially ended up impoverished. How did he feel about that?
Well, since he was elected, he had no choice but to feel their pain, no question. And he campaigns for re-election and wins a narrow victory in 1996, despite all of this. So you have to realize, in a more or less fair election, that people were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. He convinced them a second time that reform would work, and said, "I made a lot of mistakes in the first term. I'm sorry about that. We'll do it better the second time around." So after his health rebounds following that election in 1996, they have another round, a second round of economic reform, which is cut short, however, by the financial collapse of August 1998. So I think he felt badly. And, you know, he was, I don't think, a callous person. He knew that people were hurting. But he tended to take the approach that government has got to get out of the way. Now, from our point of view, he probably took that too far. But he firmly believed that the era of subsidized production, the era of guaranteed cradle-to-grave security was over in Russia. That had been the kind of social foundation of communism. But times had changed. It couldn't be done anymore.
He's, in addition to being known for, or I'm sure that people will think about him in connection with what happened with Russia's economy, there is also something else that that he did that people will think about, and that is his decision to move aggressively into Chechnya and to deal with the separatist movement there by military force, something that perhaps later he would come to regret. Why did he do that?
Well, he regretted it because they lost the first war. But he eventually changed his mind on that. And, you know, a second Chechen war, the first one starts in December 1994, and the Russian army essentially gives up on the problem in the summer of 1996 after his reelection. But a second war breaks out in August, September 1999 at the very end of Yeltsin's second term. And that war, which he argued, and I think this is essentially correct, was not taken on the Russians' initiative but on the Chechens, convinced him that his first decision had been correct, and his only regret was that they lost. So, you know, there was no one best solution to these minority problems. Russia had was not nearly as diverse as the Soviet Union, but 20 to 22%, something like that, of the population was ethnically non-Russian. And most of these people lived in homelands, essentially areas where this particular group had lived for centuries. And the Chechens were the only one of all the many minorities who were not willing to settle for a kind of peaceful accommodation within the Russian Federation. The others, many of which were much larger than the Chechen group, were willing to kind of work something out pragmatically, and Yeltsin was very happy to deal with them. You know, the Chechen thing is a very complex problem. I think that an armed rebellion against central authority is a very dangerous thing to do. Imagine if it happened in the United States. And, you know, you take your chances when you do this. I think the fighters themselves don't deserve a lot of sympathy, and most of them have been wiped out now after following the Second War. The sufferings of the population, though, are something else again. That was truly awful. I think the key cause of that was that the weakness of the Russian state after the collapse of the Soviet Union was such that essentially the Russian army couldn't fight. If it had been capable of a surgical strike, go in and arrest the leaders of the rebel government and, you know, hold elections or something like that, most of us probably would have thought that was perfectly fine. It turned into a bloodbath largely because of incompetence on the Russian side. And I don't think Yeltsin ever reconsidered his opinion about that. The Second War, though, in this case, it's essentially initiated by the Chechens themselves, or by a faction among the Chechens. And I think there's no – Russia simply had to respond. What else would you do? And so a second war was fought. Only this time the Russian army outlasted the rebels. And there may be, of course, another war in future, but not for a long time, I think.
Mm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Timothy Colton. He's professor of government and Russian studies at Harvard University, has authored many books and articles about Soviet and Russian history and politics, and he's the author of a newly published biography of Boris Yeltsin. The title is Yeltsin, A Life, and it's published by Basic Books. It's out now. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How would you assess his ability to deal with foreign leaders of that is of other countries, and how it, you know, how it was he thought about Russia's position on the world stage during the time that he was in power?
Well, Yeltsin was the author of the dismemberment of the Soviet Union, and he I think regretted the fact that Russia had to part with its empire, but believed that it was historically necessary. But one consequence of what happened was that Russia was cut down to size. That is, a superpower became a big, very poor European state, but no longer, except in terms of nuclear arsenals, a superpower. And I think he found that quite hard to adjust to. It was not to his liking. Moreover, he had no real experience at all in foreign affairs. He'd barely been abroad. Probably spent a total of a couple of months outside of the Soviet Union in his whole life until that point. His foreign minister at the time, Andrei Kozyrev, took it upon himself to make visits to all of the Western capitals in 1991. So he went to Bonn, to London, to Washington, and so forth, to try and brief foreign leaders on what Yeltsin was like. And he said, essentially, he doesn't know a lot about international relations, but he wants to be cooperative. He wants to get some things done. So you're going to have to connect with him on a personal level. It can't be just business cut and dry. And that, you know, worked to some extent. But I don't think foreign policy was his strong suit. I also think that Russia's weakness was such that in terms at least of East-West relations with the NATO alliance, there was very little that Russia could do. I think its hands were really tied. It was down and out, and everybody knew it. Now, Yeltsin believed that when reform bore fruit, that Russia would come back, not as an imperial power, but as a great power. And one might argue from the vantage point of 2008 that this is essentially what has happened. He didn't speak any foreign languages. So all of his interactions with people like Bill Clinton or Helmut Kohl or John Major, all of whom he respected, were through interpreters. Like a lot of Russians, though, the generational factor was very important. So although he made a show of friendship with Clinton, I don't think they were really deep friends. Whereas Helmut Kohl, who was born in the 30s, that was different. I think they shared a rather deeper bond.
A few months before he stepped down, he appointed Vladimir Putin as the prime minister. And at that point, it seemed to be clear that that Putin was going to be would likely be the next president of Russia. And this was, at this time, I think that a lot of people, they'd never heard of Mr. Putin before. And maybe indeed people who studied Russia and Russian politics knew who he was, or at least the name was familiar. But for most people, this certainly would not have been a familiar figure. Why do you think that he chose Putin, and what sort of connection was there between these two men before that point?
Well, Yeltsin was by this time rather obsessed with the challenge of finding a successor. He had to find somebody who would continue his work, so to say, but also who would be electable, because at that point Russian elections were still very competitive and unpredictable. He had tried out a lot of others. He never actually said straight out that this or that person was his chosen heir or successor until he did it with Putin in August 1999. But I think he tried on for size quite a few others. I could give you a list. Some of whom were older men of his generation. Others were younger. And the young whippersnappers, I think this was his preference for somebody much considerably younger. But they kind of failed the test of the August of the 1998 financial crisis. And when the second Chechen war broke out, I think he also thought about finding somebody whose main virtue was strength rather than liberality. And so Putin appealed to him. He thought he saw in Putin a combination of these qualities, that Putin, who had been known as a pretty progressive person, he'd worked with the very democratically minded mayor of St. Petersburg for most of the 1990s, that Putin would be both democratic and also though somebody who could really kind of stiffen the spine of the Russian state. The state weakness factor that I talked about was really hampering them on every front. So they had to be able now to send armies to fight actual wars and not just train for them. They had to be able to collect taxes, which they were terrible at doing at this point. And so Putin was kind of hybrid figure who summed up all the virtues that Yeltsin valued. And at first, he was not disappointed. Putin, early in his first term, did many of the things I think that Yeltsin wanted him to do, including a certain amount of recentralization of the federal system, fixing the budget deficit, things of that nature. Putin was greatly assisted by the rebound in the Russian economy, which was enabled by the liberal reforms of the 1990s, but also by the jump in world oil prices. However, eventually the two became quite estranged. This is a very sensitive matter. I didn't get the chance to ask Yeltsin about it. Family members told me quite a bit, but it's information that has to be handled with some delicacy. Essentially, after about 2 years, they stopped meeting regularly, Yeltsin increasingly, I think, came to believe that he'd made a mistake. He never said that straight out. He chose not to. I think he felt partly it was probably just, again, pragmatism. If he criticized Putin, who knew what the consequences would be for his family in particular. He also felt, I think, a considerable responsibility for having selected Putin. So who am I now to criticize him? And thirdly, Yeltsin was not the type to make idle statements. If he wanted to get something done, he wanted to get it done. And I think he realized that there was really no way he could unseat Putin or really change his behavior, and that he took as counsel of caution. So they didn't really speak at all except on protocol occasions until the last several months of Yeltsin's life. On two occasions before Yeltsin's death, which was on April 23rd of last year, the two men had long private conversations, animated conversations. But they were held in private, just the two of them. And one of the two conversants, Yeltsin, of course, is gone. And Mr. Putin knows what was said, but for the moment, he's not telling.
Mm. We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. If you wouldn't mind just shifting to the contemporary for a moment.
Sure.
I'm sure that people followed at least the change of power that happened recently in Russia, where Mr. Putin step down as president. The position is term limited, so it would have taken something like a change in the Constitution or a declaration of national emergency for him to do otherwise. But he stepped down. We have a new president, which he selected, this man, Mr. Medvedev. And then Mr. Putin became the prime minister. And I think that everyone expects that he will continue to be a very powerful and influential person in Russia for the foreseeable future. What of Mr. Medvedev? Is he just a figurehead, or are we likely to actually see him exercising some significant power?
Well, I think he is a figurehead probably for the moment. He is being very cautious. The fact that Putin has left office but not given up power sorely constrains him. Moreover, without question, he's a friend of Putin's and respects him greatly. So I wouldn't expect much to happen just for the moment. But, you know, the office that he now holds, he's the third president now of the new Russia, is extremely powerful one. And he has the right to emit decrees on almost any subject. He's commander-in-chief of the military. He is supposed to define foreign policy questions. So he's got a lot of things going for him. If push comes to shove, I think Putin is quite aware that a tussle between the two of them could end up on Medvedev's terms. But I don't think it's going to come to that. My guess is that Medvedev will strike somewhat of an independent course over, say, the next 12 to 18 months. And Putin will then be faced with a choice. Either he accepts this and essentially leaves, or he has to start resisting it. So I think that's the moment to watch for, is when we get enough divergence that there's some real air between the two of them. And I, you know, these predictions are very dangerous, but I can only say I think there's a reasonable chance that this will happen. And if so, my guess is that Putin will leave. But there are other scenarios that are taken very seriously in Moscow, including the idea of Putin simply coming back to the presidency. He was limited to two terms by the 1993 Constitution, but the Constitution refers only to consecutive terms. Mm-hmm. So it would be apparently quite legal for Putin to come back in 2012 or later as elected president.
Well, can you point to, say, and we don't unfortunately have a lot of time, but can you point to, say, one particular issue where you would say that Mr. Putin and Mr. Medvedev have diametrically opposed positions?
No, I can't find one in which they are diametrically opposed. But you probably would have said that about Yeltsin and Putin as well. You know, even when positions are not opposed black and white, the grays can make a lot of difference. Mm. And I think there is one thing that we've seen in Medvedev's first month, which has to do with rule of law. He is a lawyer by training, as was Putin. But Putin, of course, went to law school in order to join the KGB. Medvedev becomes a mature lawyer at a time when the KGB is already gone. He has no interest in this, as far as we can tell. He has now made several very pointed statements about judicial independence and the courts finally becoming a full standing branch of Russian government. These are just straws in the wind, but the Constitutional Court, which is a little bit analogous to our Supreme Court, has already issued several rulings which are, you know, rather surprising in their liberality. So these are only baby steps, nothing more than that. But it would seem as if this is the area that Medvedev has kind of roped off, saying this is where I'm going to do my innovating. And it's hard for Putin to oppose because on paper he's committed to the same objective. It's just that we know that the way rule of law worked in Putin's two terms as president, it was selective application of justice and not universal. So the rhetoric was similar to what Medvedev is using, but the application was very different. In Medvedev's case, the rhetoric is a little bit more pointed, but already we're seeing some indications that the arbitrary nature of the Russian state, which goes back, good Lord, to the Tsars and even further, may now be open to reinterpretation. And so we should, you know, by next year be seeing some signs of actual changes in behavior, if I'm right about that, if this guess of mine is correct.
Our guest, Timothy Colton, he is professor of government and Russian studies and director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. His new book is Yeltsin, A Life. It's published by Basic Books. Professor Colton, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And also thanks to Evan Whitney, who was the engineer there at the other end of the connection at Harvard.
WILL programming is made possible in part by the U of I College of Law. Established in 1897, the U of I College of Law is committed to the highest standards of academic excellence. More information and a schedule of upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu.
You're tuned to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. It's noon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In Kansas City, September wheat is trading at $8.90.